It's Diane. On my mind, questions about where we are in the pandemic and when it might end. My guest is Dr. Anthony Fauci. He's director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and chief medical advisor to the president. Throughout the pandemic, he's been America's most visible public health official, hailed as a hero by most and vilified by some. As we are about to enter our third year in the struggle to combat the virus, I asked Dr. Fauci his thoughts on when the current Omicron wave might recede, how the government is responding, and when he expects a return to normal or new normal.
The 20 minutes is starting now.
Hi, Diane. How are you?
Well, I'm fine. I'm not going to waste even 20 seconds.
Go. Let's do it.
Let's do it. Dr. Fauci, where are we today in this Omicron wave? Have we reached or are we passing the peak?
Well, since this is a large country, Diane, in some cities we've reached the peak and it's starting to turn around. For example, in New York City, it's very clear that they've reached the peak and are turning around. In Chicago, the same thing. But in some other states and cities, particularly in the southern areas of the country, they have not yet peaked and they're still going up. The pattern of this outbreak in other countries, for example, in South Africa, in Israel, and in the UK, have all shown a pattern of a very sharp increase, a peak, and a turnaround. I believe that ultimately we will see this throughout the country, but it's not going to be unidimensionally across the country. It'll be some cities doing it sooner than others.
Is there a relationship you can define between those states where masks are worn as a majority and those that are not?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is something that's been very clear, that the states that do not wear masks and do not vaccinate, the under-vaccinated states, clearly have a much higher degree of not only infection, but also hospitalizations and deaths. There's a correlation. If you look at the data, it's very clear, Diane. If you look at hospitalizations, severe disease, and death, and compare unvaccinated with vaccinated individuals, the unvaccinated are 10 times more likely to get infected, 17 times more likely to be hospitalized, and 20 times more likely to die. There's a major difference between unvaccinated and vaccinated people.
Is this virus or some variation of it one we're going to have to live with for a very long time? For example, the flu shot, getting vaccinations each year? Or do you think this and variations will simply disappear?
It's very unlikely, Diane, that it's going to simply disappear, because when you think in terms of pandemics, there are five major buckets, I think you could put them in. Pandemic phase, deceleration phase, control, elimination, and eradication. If you work from the bottom up, it is extremely unlikely that we're going to eradicate this virus because of its high degree of transmissibility. We've only eradicated one virus in the history of public health, and that is smallpox. And we did that by a massive vaccination campaign. Aspirationally, we'd like to eliminate it, but that would require a very, very powerful vaccination campaign like we did with polio, where we eliminated it from this country, but it still is present in some places throughout the world. So although we'd like to see it eliminated where there are no cases in the United States, that is unlikely given the fact that about 37% of the population is not fully vaccinated. So then you get into the third category, which is control. And by control, we mean getting enough people vaccinated and boosted together with people who've been infected and recovered so that the level of immunity at the community level is high enough that you don't get a infection rate that negatively impacts the way we live and act in society. Now, that would mean having a level that is commensurate with other respiratory infections, RSV, paraflu, influenza. If we get that low, then that would likely be something that we'd be able to accept the way we accept others. However, there's a big caveat there, Diane, because that's assuming that we don't get any additional variants that would evade the vaccination protection and evade the protection that you get from prior infection. So there's a best case scenario and there's a worst case scenario. The best case scenario is that it goes down to such a low level, we can return to a greater degree of normality. And the worst case scenario is that we get another confounding variant, which could happen. The likelihood of that happening is greater the fewer people that get vaccinated.
I want to ask you about that resistance to vaccination. And maybe it has nothing to do with COVID. But many people, I don't know how many, who received the polio vaccine ended up with Guillain-Barré syndrome later in life. There are many people who are unvaccinated and remain so, are worried about just that kind of long-term effect. What do you say to them?
But the data don't show that to be correct. I mean, the only time there was an increase in Guillain-Barré following vaccination was in the 1976 flu scare. It wasn't a flu outbreak. It was a scare that we vaccinated, we being the United States. 1976 is a long time ago. But with polio, if you look at the level of Guillain-Barré in society that's related to other things besides vaccination, there's no greater increase among polio vaccinations or other vaccinations. The time that we did see that, as I mentioned, was in 1976 with influenza vaccination.
So you are in no way concerned as to what could be the long-term effects of this vaccine 20, 30 years down the line.
You know, Diane, when you talk about concern, it's all in relative risk. No one can say you have absolutely zero concern. It's like saying I have no concern that when I walk out of this building, I'm going to get hit by lightning. You know, it can happen. It's extremely unlikely. So if you look at the history of the long-term complications of vaccines, the history of vaccinology is very, very safe, with very, very few exceptions.
I have now heard from three people who have tested positive for COVID who have not had a single symptom. Now, unless they had been tested, they wouldn't have known. They would have gone out to a restaurant. They would have been with other people.
Well, it's very well documented, Diane, that a substantial proportion of people who are infected either get no symptoms at all, about a third of them just never get any symptoms. That's very, very interesting and unprecedented because that's the same virus that can turn out putting other people in the hospital and killing them. And yet there's a substantial proportion, it varies, but somewhere around 30% of people get no symptoms at all. And that's one of the confounding elements of this outbreak, because there are people who are getting infected who don't know that they're infected,
right,
and are spreading it inadvertently and innocently, which is the reason why it's very important that we're putting a major emphasis on testing of people. For example, if you're getting ready to have a gathering in your home and there are people who are coming in, you might want to go the extra step, the extra mile to say, get a rapid point of care test the day of or the day before you gather for a dinner or a family or some sort of a social gathering. That's the reason why we do it, because we know that there are a considerable number of people who have no symptoms at all who are infected and are capable of transmitting it to others.
But suppose you're just planning to go out to a restaurant with your husband or wife, and you have no symptoms. You wear your mask to walk in, and then you take your mask off to drink and eat. How do you know you're not passing it on?
Well, that's the point, and that's the reason why when you have a level of infection in the community where you have 800,000 to a million people getting infected each day, the recommendations of the CDC are that when you are in an indoor congregate setting, that even though you're vaccinated and boosted, that you wear a mask. Now, if you want to go to the restaurant, it very likely is not a big risk, but it is a risk because it's indoor and people are going to be taking their masks off to eat. That doesn't mean you should never go to a restaurant, but I think you should accept the fact that when you're having 800,000 new infections per day in a city that has a very high level of infection, that you are taking a risk in an indoor congregate setting without a mask.
So you haven't been to a restaurant since this began?
Early on, before there was the 800,000 cases a day, I think maybe once or twice in 2 years or so I was in a restaurant, but not any more than that. I'm not saying that everyone should feel that way. You're asking me a question about me. I'm not making a public health recommendation here because, as usual, it will be taken out of context.
Now a quick break. When we come back, more of my conversation with Dr. Anthony Fauci. And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Dr. Anthony Fauci, Director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and the Chief Medical Advisor to President Biden. What changes will be made if COVID does become endemic? What will we as a society have to accept?
Well, if it becomes endemic at a low enough level that it isn't any worse than respiratory syncytial virus or parainfluenza or any of those other respiratory viruses, then we could very likely get back very close, if not exactly, to the degree of normality that we were before. But it depends, and that's a big if, at what level this virus essentially assimilates itself into our lives. If the level is no worse than any other respiratory infection, it very likely will just have to accept living with it. But we're not there yet, Diane. We're not there when you have 800,000 infections a day, 156,000 people in the hospital, and 2,000 deaths per day. Hopefully, we will get there sooner rather than later, but we're not there yet.
So, this week, the government rolled out programs to pass out free home tests and N95 masks. Some people are asking, why didn't this happen a long time ago?
Well, certainly a surge of Omicron was unanticipated that it would be this bad. The president himself has said and admitted, honestly, that we could have done better and we should have had tests available earlier. But as you said, right now, we have a totally unprecedented amount of tests available. 500 million tests starting a couple of days ago being sent out, another 500 million tests, getting the ability to get it online sent to your home. But if you compare the tests now, even today, even before we have the full complement of tests, compared to what it was a year ago, it's infinitely greater.
We've been seeing a move back to schools, but for young people who are younger than 5, very, very difficult since they cannot be vaccinated. What about those poor teachers? What about those poor parents? Should we be moving more quickly to vaccinate children younger than five?
Well, certainly we are going as quickly as we possibly can. You don't want to vaccinate children if you are not sure of the safety and the efficacy of the vaccine. The tests that were done by the company to determine whether or not it would be safe and effective were partially positive, but part of the tests did not show the level of protection that they felt was necessary. Right now,
so what happened? What did that look like?
It looked like the dose likely was not the proper dose for the children who were 24 months up to 4 years. It appeared that the dose was okay for the younger ones, but again, that's an FDA issue that I should not and do not want to comment on, except to say it's in the hands of the FDA, who will do their usual job of assuring safety and efficacy before they approve any product for anyone, particularly children.
Do you think there may have been too much emphasis on vaccines and not enough emphasis on medications to deal with early signs of COVID?
There's the impression that that's the case, but it isn't the case. If you look at what was, for certainly we have a strong emphasis on vaccines. It's already saved hundreds of millions of lives throughout the world. So that was an appropriate emphasis. There was also an emphasis that was not very well recognized on therapy. The first couple of months of the outbreak in January, February, March of 2020, studies done by the NIH showed that the drug remdesivir was effective in preventing an individual from advancing diseases. Monoclonal antibodies in the very early months were developed by companies such as Regeneron, Lilly, and the National Institutes of Health played a major role in the development of one of those antibodies. So a lot was done, wasn't fully appreciated, but still, Diane, having said that, we still need to do more. And when you look back, you always feel you should have done more. But I think it's really inaccurate to say that we did not pay attention to therapies. That's not the case.
Would you agree that some messages from the government to the public have been confusing?
Well, the answer is yes. And I think you heard a very honest appraisal a couple of days ago in one of the media outlets that Rochelle Walensky, who is the director of the CDC, who's done a very good job, has said there were instances where there could have been better communication. She was open and honest about it and is saying that they will try to improve, and they improve not only with the CDC, but all of the government. I don't think we should putting all the burden on the CDC for that. We should say we all probably need to communicate a bit better.
We only have a couple of minutes left. I want to know about the personal attacks against you and what that has been like for you and your family.
Well, obviously, it had to be very disturbing, Diane, and it still is. I mean, and I mentioned that at the hearing, that that triggers other people on the outside to be doing crazy things like threatening my life in reality. I mean, real, live, credible threats that lead to arrests. We're not talking about just people who are just sending little text messages. It's really unfortunate because that is a big diversion from what we should be doing. I'm being demonized by certain elements in society merely because I'm saying we should be vaccinated, we should get boosted, we should be wearing masks. This is unprecedented, I believe, in history, where public health officials like myself, and I'm not alone, I'm not the only one I'm just the most visible one that's being demonized, are getting demonized because they're making common sense, tried and true public health recommendations. We're doing no more nor no less than that. And because of that, we're being threatened. That's a really sorry indictment of society, that there are people who are doing that, who are using pure ad hominems for political purposes. And there's no doubt that it's for political purposes. I mean, that was proven at the hearing the other day.
You mean your exchange with Senator Rand Paul?
Well, you know what happened. I don't want to get into that. I mean, it was very clear that there was, you know, political motivation of being ad hominem attacks on me, using that to raise money for political causes.
Can you still get out and run as you used to?
Well, I do more power walking than running, Diane. When you used to interview me years ago, I was running. Now that I'm 81 years old, I'm doing more walking than running.
Well, as long as you keep in good shape, because we need you.
All right. Thank you, Diane. That's very nice of you. It's always good to be with you.
Thank you for being with us. That was Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and chief medical advisor to the president. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Lansberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Adrian Danhauser. Thanks for listening, all. Be well, stay safe, take care of yourself and those around you. I'm Diane Rehm.